Thursday, September 11th at 6 p.m., join us at the Riverside Church with former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, editor and publisher Mike Rupert, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, Dr. Faust Khan, and John Judge for a film exhibit and forum, Reframing 9/11. This is the kickoff event for a weekend-long forum at the Riverside Church, exploring alternatives to the current path of endless war, environmental devastation, corporate welfare, and the dismantling of our U.S. Constitution. This event is sponsored by WBAI, 9/11 Citizens Watch, and the WBAI program Ain't That Good News. 2 years later, and it is obvious, the truth has been kept from us. Come to the Riverside Church at 490 Riverside Drive. Take the 1 of the 9 to 116th Street. This is a free event with suggested donation. Visit WBAI.org for more information. Seek truth.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. It's Emmanuel Goldstein, live from Krakow, Poland. It's 1 o'clock in the morning here. Time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. Bundle it low.
Okay, are we here?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Well, this week I can't hear the intro. Last week I couldn't hear the announcement before the intro. This week I heard the announcement, but I can't hear the intro.
You can't hear your own music right now?
I can't hear a thing right now.
Wow.
So I suggest that all the engineers at the radio station run in there right now and figure out why the intro is not being transmitted to Poland, but everything else is. There's a secret switch or button there somewhere in the studio, and I've long been trying to find that secret switch or button, and this is our opportunity to figure it all out. This is Off the Hook, the program about technology and its various malfunctions, which makes all this kind of thing all the more enjoyable. I'm here in Poland on the return of my 6 weeks over here, which really have flown by for me. I've been going from one place to another so fast that my head is swimming. Since last week when I was in Russia, I've been to Moscow since then, and then Belarus, and now I've passed through Warsaw again, and I'm in Krakow on my way to Prague. I'll be back in the studio next week, and meeting a lot of people, talking about a lot of things, meeting hackers everywhere, and boy, it's an interesting world out here. It really is. I recommend this to all kinds of people. It's not something that's at all expensive either. You find that when you're wandering around places like this, it's actually cheaper to be wandering around, staying in places, and hanging out here than it is to be living back home. Of course, you still have to worry about the things that are going on back home that you have to take care of. But if it wasn't for that, you know, it'd be a lot cheaper just to survive living in Eastern Europe. I'll tell you that.
So, what's the next stop?
Next stop for me is Prague, and then after that, I'm pretty much heading back. So, I'll be in the studio next week, and you'll hear my voice not over the telephone, but live in the studio.
What'd you bring us?
Well, lots of photographs and stories and memories and. You know, things like that. You know, I bring, you know, tangible things, but we all know that's just, you know, it's a big waste of time. So I figure, you know, the stuff from the heart, the words, the feelings, that kind of thing, that's what the real value is all about, and that's what I'm bringing back.
And not a single person has introduced themselves yet, including you.
Well, I thought I introduced myself.
He did.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not going to introduce myself again, so someone else introduced
themselves. Yeah, Jeff's here,
as is Mike.
And Jim.
And Evan.
All right. Well, it's good to have you all there.
Also Ken Gale is here.
I'm sorry.
Also, Ken Gale is here engineering for us, and we want to thank him again.
Yeah, you know, I have to point out that we have a slight delay here because the signal's being bounced all over the place. So it's important for people to realize that. It's kind of like the nightline effect, you know, where people are constantly talking over each other. It's not because, you know, we're, you know, not listening to each other. It's because my voice is delayed about half a second, and your voice is delayed about half a second getting to me. So that's the technology at work there, or not at work.
That's one of the strange, sad things about the relative demise of the space program. When they used to talk to people on the moon, you would have a concrete example of this carried to, like, the extreme. You'd have, like, a 3-4 second delay, and you'd realize, oh, yeah, it's the fact that the signal takes so long to get there and get back.
And they also have those beeps, you know, and the beeps tell you when you've, like, you know, stopped talking. Maybe we should implement that here.
I always thought that was just, you know, recording. Like,
well, when I was in Belarus, and by the way, I have to point out that the system we're using now, I have to give very, very high marks to. We're going to give out full information about the system next week when we complete the test of it. But basically, this involves going onto the internet, getting a toll-free number, and having that toll-free number be forwardable to various international numbers overseas. And you do that through the web page. You simply enter your password and your PIN and all that kind of thing, and then you enter the number in whatever country you want to forward to, and when you call that 877 number or 800 number, it goes to that number. Now, it works. I mean, we're using it right now, and it's incredibly cheap. For instance, when I was in Finland and when I was in Moscow, do you know how much it cost per minute?
No, but you do.
Well, I do, but give a guess. What do you think, you know, to call a toll-free number and speak to somebody in Moscow?
I have a guess.
Jim, I'm going to ask you, what do you think that would cost?
8 cents a minute.
8 cents a minute? How could you possibly make money for something that cheap? Guess again.
I would say it costs 0 cents a minute because I've never charged for 800 or 877 numbers.
Well, yeah, but of course you have to pay for the call somehow to get to Moscow, don't you?
Oh, well, yeah, but I'm dialing 800 numbers, so I'm not paying.
No, you're not paying.
How much will I be paying?
15 cents a minute?
Well, that's a good guess, Jeff, but I'm asking Jim. Jim,
what do you say? Oh, you said to guess again.
I'm sorry.
He jumped on me, so.
I'm actually going to go in the other direction. I'm going to assume that you're misleading us by somehow subtly implying that it's more expensive. I'll go something like 3 cents a minute.
Oh, you're wrong. It's 4 cents a minute.
Oh, damn.
But think about it. I mean, you're calling Russia. You're calling Moscow. You're using a toll-free number, and the whole thing costs you 4 cents a minute. I mean, that's incredible. That really is an amazing advantage of this kind of a system. And it's kind of what we were all pushing for, you know, back in the old days of you know, phone phreaking, where people just wanted to talk to people from other parts of the world. Well, now we can do that, and it's really, really easy, and it works really, really well. One time when it didn't work so well was in Belarus, which I was in a few days ago. Interesting thing, too, that country apparently uses in-band signaling. What that means is you can use all kinds of funny blue box tones in that country. I talked to some people there who instantly were able to recognize, yes, this country can be boxed from. So that's something to take into account. But when we were talking over in Belarus, it was very hard to understand people. There was a very long delay. I think that's just because of the nature of their phone system, not so much the system we're using from the States. But it's worked without any problems. The only problems we had were at the very beginning of this whole expedition. The first 2 weeks, we got disconnected 20 minutes into the show. That's the only time I've been disconnected, those two times. Not since, and I've had very long conversations with people since then. The other bit of technology I've been using quite a bit is a GSM phone, which is basically a cellular phone that you would use in the United States, but using the technology that everybody uses here in Europe, everybody has a GSM phone. They all use SMS technology to send messages back and forth to each other, and it's really amazing to be able to have your phone on you and send an email to somebody, a two-line email to somebody back home, or just a message to somebody's phone back home, assuming their phone accepts that technology. That kind of thing has made communicating so much easier than other times I've been traveling, and you know, you have to figure out a way to either call somebody at very expensive rates or get access to the internet. This has made things much, much easier and quicker. I'm not sure yet if it's made things much cheaper, but it's a step.
This toll-free number system also has a wide variety of strange error messages that we've occasionally managed to trigger. My favorite is if two people try and call your number at the same time, the busy recording is unlike any I've ever heard.
Well, is there a way we can bring that up?
We could try it, Ken, if we could maybe get a dial tone.
Yeah, Ken, if you have nothing else to do right now. Well, don't call the number on the air, because then everybody's going to know what the number is.
No, we won't do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to get a dial tone, then we're going to turn you down as we dial it.
Actually, you don't have to do that. You can just get a dial tone offline, dial it, and then bring it
in. We could do that, but that's a little difficult for me.
All right. Well, do whatever you have to do.
So,
We're here playing with the phones again. And in the meantime, anybody got any news stories?
I got one.
Okay.
Well, basically, today, Wednesday, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals has ordered an emergency stay delaying the new media ownership rules set forward by the FCC. Because what the Third Circuit Court said basically is that the new rules will hurt a project of a group of media access groups called the Prometheus Radio Project, and it'll hurt them irreparably. Cause them irreparable harm.
Okay, so the rules are what? Lowering the maximum number of stations that you can own?
No. The new rules allow a single company to own 45% of a media in a certain area.
This is an increase.
Yeah, it's the ones we were protesting there.
Right.
And so they're now delayed.
That's a good thing.
And one other thing is you might have heard about the new story that in Canada you're not allowed to smile on your passport photos anymore. Oh, okay.
Well, we're punching in the phone, and we hung up on ourselves.
Okay, so I'll continue. Basically, in Canada, you're not allowed to smile on your passport photos anymore.
Right.
And I think they got it. Did you get it? Or?
We think we have it.
All the lines are busy right now. Please try later.
That's fascinating.
Well, that's pretty good. Am I back?
You never left.
Okay, let me update people on a couple of things. First, the FCC story we've talked about in the past.
Yeah,
so there's nothing new there.
No, it's today they delayed it. They delayed the rules going into effect.
Okay, well, the challenge is nothing new. The 45% thing is something that the FCC is looking at. Based on the strong public outrage about it, so it's still in effect, unfortunately, but it's not. Its future is in question, and that's because of everybody speaking out against it. As for the passport thing, yeah, I have a story about that. Basically, you're not supposed to crack a smile if you take a passport photo in Canada. This is according to a news release from the Canada Passport Office. They issued some new specifications. You can see them by going to www.ppt.gc.ca, not over yet, /passports/get_photo_specs_e.asp. And let me... No, I'm not going to repeat that. You know what? You listen to it on the net. You figure it out, or you know...
If you email us, we'll reply.
Yeah,
with the
email
URL.
Us, because we don't have time to waste reading long URLs like that. That's just ridiculous. Somebody would actually put a URL like that in a news story and expect us to read it on the air, let alone twice. I'm not going to do it. Forget it. Anyway, so they issued specifications for passport photos, and they want serious faces only, but not too serious. All right, you got to be careful with this. You don't want to be frowning, you don't want to be scowling, you don't want to be glaring, and you don't want to be grimacing. To get a valid passport, Canadians must now send in two photos with what they call neutral expressions. That means a closed mouth, straight ahead gaze into the camera. Now, according to Suzanne Munier, a spokeswoman with the Passport Office, and that's how they say to pronounce it, okay, so I'm not making fun of her name. It's a pronunciation guide right here. Munier, a spokeswoman with the Passport Office, said the government is complying with recommendations of the International Civil Aviation Organization, You ever heard of them? They're the United Nations agency responsible for aviation issues. Yeah, and that's aimed at making it easier for security personnel to recognize the passport holder. That's, of course, assuming that you use that expression in real life. The new measure took effect on August 15th, but there is a smile amnesty for the next 2 months to accommodate those who have already filed happy-looking photos or who have not heard of the ban on grins. We've already received photos with small smiles that we are ready to accept, Ms. Munier said. The specifications outline some other do's and don'ts. Don't wear shades that hide your eyes. You can wear tinted prescription glasses as long as your eyeballs are showing. Hair pieces are acceptable, we're told, so long as it's not some sort of Halloween thing that alters your appearance. It has to be a hair piece that is worn regularly. As a general rule, hats are out. A photo in which the applicant is wearing a hat or a head covering or anything that interferes with the photo's value in providing a means for identifying the issuee for the benefit of border control is not acceptable for a Canadian passport or travel document. Turbans are fine, as are the headscarves worn by Muslim women, but not veils that hide the face, favored by the most conservative Muslims. While allowances may be made for practitioners of religious faith that prohibit the removal of the head covering, photos in which the full facial features of the subject are not visible are not acceptable. Now, the organization's goal is to have face recognition scanners in airports around the world in the not-too-distant future. Some security experts are arguing for fingerprinting or iris scanning, but the ICAO believes those are too intrusive. So that's what they're looking at in the future, is face recognition scanners based on your passport photo. I think that's going to make things really interesting.
Yeah, isn't that the reason they wanted the no smiling, so that they had a database of photos to do the comparisons?
Yeah, but what if you crack a big smile as you're walking through the airport and you don't, like, you know, release it until you get on the plane?
Well, that would be the defense, sure.
Yeah, then you get in trouble for that.
Exactly.
Well, what happens is that the reason they're putting this into place, why the passports, is because they tested out the system, the facial recognition system in Logan Airport in 2002, and the UCLA got recently the a report from the Massachusetts Port Authority about the success of the system. Basically, it had a 38% failure rate when it sees people walking around. But the company that makes the facial recognition systems, named Visage, that's with V-I-I-S-A-G-E, their president, whose name is Bernard Bailey, he said that the system works best if it's if it checks out passport photos, basically. So that's what they're doing. So instead of having just a person look at it, at your passport, they're going to probably scan it to the system, the photo.
Moving along, we have a story sent to us by Bernie S. Concerning a Reuters story last week about John Ashcroft's Patriot Act promotional tour. That's right. This is real. It really is a Patriot Act promotional tour. He sent a letter to all 113 U.S. attorneys, who are the top federal prosecutors, encouraging them to hold town hall-style meetings in their districts to promote the Patriot Act. Now, Ashcroft's own highly publicized rallies were closed to the public and were open only to police and other law enforcement officials. Now, this letter Bernie sent us earlier said that he called the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, which includes Philadelphia, to find out when and where his U.S. Attorney's Patriot public promotional event would be held. Well, guess what? They claim to know nothing about it. After talking with several people there, he got one of them to agree to call him back if she learned anything. And late yesterday, he got a call from the U.S. Attorney's Office, which isn't usually a very good thing for Bernie S., but in this case it was. He was told that this public meeting would be held tonight, Wednesday night, at 7 p.m. Exactly the same time that Off the Hook starts. And don't think that's not intentional. Now, the person who called him said that they didn't really have time to publicize this meeting. And he said to her that the DOJ apparently spent a great deal of time and money promoting the closed to the public Ashcroft speaking engagements. She explained there were budgetary constraints that prevented her office from publicizing the public meetings. It's unbelievable here. He called some reporter friends at local newspapers and radio stations. Nobody had seen any press releases about this. Now, the fact that the DOJ chose not to publicize these public meetings speaks volumes. Apparently, they don't want any real public input about the Patriot Act.
They only tell their friends about it, and of course, Bernie pretended to be a Patriot Act supporter, which probably is why they called him back. And that way they can say they held public meetings and there was little or no opposition. So anyway, Bernie right now at this particular moment in time is at that meeting or trying to get into that meeting or something like that. I just want to say it's been very nice knowing Bernie S. And I hope, you know, our paths cross someday in the future, rather. And we'll see what happens to him at this meeting tonight. Now, Mike, you have more information on this whole thing, like how... This whole Ashcroft tour is going on and what it means and possibly some meetings in New York?
Well, there may be a meeting in New York. I tried following Bernie's advice and calling the U.S. Attorney Office for the Southern District of New York, which is where we all live if we live in New York City. And I got sent to someone's voicemail, so I'll see if they call me back. But if our listeners want to try calling them, the phone number is 212-637-2200, and you too can get sent to voicemail.
That's the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York?
That is indeed.
Thank you.
Mike, tell us more about this whole Ashcroft tour. I know you were telling us something about it in email. What's this all about? He's going around to various towns talking about the Patriot Act or something?
As far as I know, it's some kind of Patriot Act defense tour. Even the Republican Congress is starting to say this Patriot Act is going a little too far with the, you know, just walking into people's houses, looking around and not telling them. So there was some portion of the act which they cut funding to. So it's still legal for the FBI to, like, come into your house and not tell you, but they can't spend any money on it, at least not federal funds. So John Ashcroft is going on this tour to talk about how wonderful the Patriot Act is and how it's fighting terrorism and whatever else it allegedly does. We're not invited to see John Ashcroft. As you said before, only law enforcement is allowed to see that, but he's putting pressure, I guess, on all the U.S. attorney's offices, which are the kind of local branches of the Department of so-called Justice, and they are supposed to put on these town hall-style meetings where the local U.S. attorney can tell you all about the wonders of the Patriot Act.
Why don't you give us that number one more time?
Sure, the number for Southern District of New York is 212-637-2200. And if you don't live in New York City and you want to call your local U.S. attorney, there's a website for the Justice Department, and you can click on U.S. Attorney's Office and scroll down through the list and find it that way.
And if you find out when these meetings are, please email us, oth@2600.com, and let us know so we can let people know over the radio, because it's very important that if they're going to have a public hearing, you know, a town hall meeting, wouldn't it be nice if the town actually showed up? You know, not nice for them, maybe, but nice for the town.
What do you think, Emmanuel? Should we give Bernie S. a call?
Well, Mike's going to try calling Bernie off air to see if,
Okay.
Nothing worse than calling somebody in the middle of a meeting and having the cell phone go off. You know, he might be chastised for that, even though he is a Patriot Act supporter.
Okay.
Speaking of federal government fund, this is interesting. This is really kind of funny, actually. The U.S. Computer and Communications Industry Association, which is another organization I'll bet you never heard of, CCIA, they've urged the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to avoid using Microsoft software. That's right. The Washington-based association, which represents members that generate over $200 billion, has issued an open letter to Tom Ridge, Secretary of the Department, urging him to review his decision to choose Microsoft for its desktops and servers. It claims that the events relating to the blaster and So Big Worms have highlighted problems in cybersecurity. The letter from Ed Black, the association's president, said, "We believe that for software to be truly secure, it must be well-written from the outset, with security considerations given a high priority. It accuses Microsoft of being more interested in economic marketing and competition than security, and said the lack of diversity within a network system amplifies the risk emanating from any vulnerabilities that do exist. It continues, our preliminary findings indicate the severity of the security problems relating to some Microsoft software. The blaster worm, it said, caused an intrusion into the Navy Marine intranet, crashed the CSX railway system, Maryland's Department of Motor Vehicles, Air Canada systems, and most seriously, earlier this year, a nuclear power plant was downed by Slammer. Microsoft, it claims, isn't guiltless because it is continuing to create software riddled with obvious and easily exploited vulnerabilities. Now, that is a condemnation like I've never heard before, and it'll be interesting to see if the Department of Homeland Security heeds that warning.
Now, personally, I disagree with the recommendation. I think the Department of Homeland Security should run all kinds of Microsoft products, especially older, known to be buggy and crashy versions. So.
Yeah, just in keeping with their overall image, I guess.
Did it mention what they were going to move to?
Well, was there a recommendation? Department of Security hasn't actually accepted any of these recommendations yet, but it'll be interesting to see what they wind up doing, if anything. But I would guess probably they won't do anything. But here's something else interesting. The blaster worm apparently has been linked to the August 14th blackout in New York City and throughout the Northeast United States. According to government and industry experts, they revealed last week that the W32, that blaster worm, may have contributed to the cascading effect of the blackout. On the day of the blackout, Blaster degraded the performance of several communications lines linking key data centers used by utility companies to manage the power grid. It didn't affect the control systems internally, but it most certainly affected the timeliness of the data they were receiving from other networks. That's according to Gary Seifert, a researcher at the U.S. Department of Energy's Idaho National Engineering and Environmental Laboratory in Idaho Falls. The inability of critical control data to be exchanged quickly across the grid could have hampered the operator's ability to prevent the cascading effect of the blackout. But nobody is certain, actually, what caused the blackout in the first place.
Two comments here. Number one, can you say scapegoat? And number two, it could have been C4, which many of our friends will remember from some years back.
Well, another thing that's also interesting, and this points to the Microsoft vulnerabilities again, a former Bush administration advisor who has consulted with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security on the power grid issue, and it's funny how the Department of Homeland Security keeps coming up in all these conversations about computer security now. They said the blaster worm also hampered the ability of utilities in the New York region to restore power in a more timely manner because some of those companies were running Windows-based control systems with port 135 open, and that's the port through which the worm attacked systems. Now, the control systems that have been referred to, also known as Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition, SCADA systems, they're used to manage large industrial operations such as natural gas, electric power grids, that kind of thing, and they're often based on Windows 2000 or XP operating systems. They rely on commercial data links, including the internet and wireless systems for exchanging information. Now, Scott Charney, chief security strategist at Microsoft Corporation, said that Blaster raised a security and network performance issue for all Microsoft customers and that there was nothing unique about the electric power industry. I find it very interesting. Scott Charney used to be the chief of the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Task Force of the United States Department of Justice. He was one of the key people trying to prosecute fiber optic. Used to be on this radio show and members of Masters of Deception, the hacker group back in the 80s and 90s. So it's funny how the same names keep surfacing in this world of ours.
Can I add something to what Jim said about scapegoat?
Go ahead.
The utility near Dayton, Ohio, that seems to have been traced to be the very first one that had its problem that on August 14th, the beginning of the blackout. The people who run that, who own it, are among the largest campaign contributors to George W. Bush.
Well, gee, that sort of makes everything make sense, doesn't it?
And so I don't think we will ever find the cause of the blackout because the cause of the blackout is going to point in their direction. And so I think things like this are exactly what Jim said, is a scapegoat.
and they'll be
okay.
I believe the owner of Yet Utility is the third largest fundraiser for George W. So you're not going to blame him for anything after all.
And there'll be
no,
more blackout.
Think of it.
there's going to be more blackout-related stuff on a show that Ken will be doing on September 9th, I believe.
Yeah, this coming Tuesday.
At what time?
11 a.m.
Here on...
Oh, that should be here on this radio station.
Yes, which is, of course, WBAI New York 99.5 FM, where it's 7:30 and we have half the show left.
Now, speaking of blame, scapegoats, that kind of thing, they actually are pinning the worm on somebody, or at least part of the worm on somebody, and this clears the way for me returning home, actually, because now that passed on somebody, I can feel that there won't be any problems at the border, but we'll see. By the way, I should point out, I've been through so many borders, and scary ones, too, you know, ones with all kinds of border controls, and they really take it very seriously, you know, stamping the passport and looking you over, but have not had any problems whatsoever at any of the places I was told I was going to have problems, such as Russia and Belarus. People have been very friendly, and it's really been quite nice. But of course, you know, I probably jinxed it by saying this now, and of course I have the United States to look forward to, so we'll see what happens to me back then.
Let's spend a minute on this. You've crossed the borders by plane, correct?
Not here, no. I've been crossing by train.
By train?
Yeah.
Is it like in the old 1930s movies where guys in uniforms get on and ask you for your passports and scowl at you?
Oh, yeah, but, you know, that's not just in the 1930s. That's been going on since, you know, the dawn of Christ, I think. I mean, people have been, you know, walking around in uniforms asking for your... In Russia, it's crazy because people ask you for your passport for the craziest things. You go to Burger King, they ask you for your passport. It's ridiculous. Everyone's passport happy over there. They're just constantly asking for papers and little certificates, and they're stamping things everywhere. You know, it's funny for the first couple of days, but after that, it gets kind of old. Anyway.
When I returned from Europe recently, the U.S. stamped my passport, which isn't supposed to happen.
Yes, and you promised to let me see that when I come back.
Yes, you may see it.
All right. They did do mine as well.
Yeah, I was surprised. When I entered my country, they stamped the passport.
There's a blank line there for how long you're allowed to stay in the country. They haven't filled it in yet, but I could.
And I suggested that you fill it in and like, sort of deport yourself somehow. But they use the big silver stamping thing?
It's orange.
Orange?
Orange ink.
Okay, I have to see this. Anyway, to get back to the story about the worm, this guy in Minnesota, identified as Jeffrey Lee Parson, 18 years old. He's known online as T-Kid, T-E-E-K-I-D. Now, I don't know him online as that. I don't know who does know him online as that, where he hung out or anything like that. But he has been accused of unleashing a damaging virus-like infection weeks ago on the Internet. Now, he was to make his initial court appearance last Friday in St. Paul, Minnesota. I haven't heard anything about what happened there. But basically, different versions of the virus-like worm, ultimately called Lovesan or Blaster, snarled computer networks worldwide. And we've all heard of the problems that it's been accused of causing. Basically, he's accused of writing the Blaster.B version of the infection, and that began spreading on August 13th. Now, here's the thing. It's remarkably similar to the original Blaster worm that first struck 2 days earlier, and experts say the author made few changes, renaming the infecting file from MS Blast to an anatomical reference. I can't get anybody to tell me what that anatomical reference is, but that's what it was renamed to. If someone knows what that is, please email us, oth@2600.com. Now, what I'm wondering here is, did this guy just simply take the code from the original worm, change a couple of lines, and put it someplace, and now he's getting blamed for writing the original one as well? You know, no one can really... In any news story I've read, no one has been very specific as to what exactly he's being accused of doing. If he simply copied the file, made a change, is that the same thing as initially sending it out and causing all kinds of mayhem and destruction?
I would think it's probably just as bad. You've taken something and re-released it and in another form.
Well, then that leads to my second question. What did he do with it? Re-releasing it, what does that entail? Does that mean posting it on a website? Does that mean emailing it? Does that mean putting it on a Usenet news group? you know, on a bulletin board in a supermarket? What exactly
would
he do?
I would think that would mean just emailing it out and starting it on its own little course.
Uh-huh. And how many people do you need to email it out to for it to actually get started?
I think just one.
Just one? So he could have emailed it to a friend of his, perhaps?
Possibly.
Okay, well, you know, it's interesting. I'd just like to know more details as to what exactly they're accusing this person of. Not taking any sides here. I'm not saying someone is guilty or innocent. I just want to know more details, and there's surprisingly few in all the stories I've read about this. But I see his face everywhere. I see the poor guy's face on all the news sites, and it's, you know, it's you wonder what's going to happen to him.
And it's interesting, too, that they're... I'm going to have to check and see where I have mine, but there were books you could buy in Barnes & Noble, any of the bookstores, that basically were about viruses and had a little disc inside with examples of viruses. So this stuff has been out there and available to anyone and everyone.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing, too, also, Jeff, is that the exploit that this particular worm took advantage of had been made public a month earlier. So... a month earlier, think about that. Now, the blaster worm comes out, and it still works. And then blaster.b comes out, and that still works. Well, you know, at this point, who is really at fault here if this thing is still working?
Well, I think you could equate that to, you know, gee, I told you your house was unlocked. I came back next week and the door was still unlocked, so now I'm coming in and robbing you.
Yeah, but Jeff, my house is not a commercial product that I'm selling to people and guaranteeing some kind of security and efficiency.
No, but the lock is that's on the door. Okay, it's the responsibility of the person that owns the product to go ahead and add the patch. You know, you're made aware that, hey, there's a security hole. Here's a patch. It's on the website. You download it for free. So, you know, it is a sticky area. You know, it's hard to kind of pin blame and well, you didn't do this. You're at fault. So,
well, maybe our listeners can help us figure out a way to put the blame on this. We'd like to know, you know, is it up to the individual user? Is it up to the community in general? Is it up to Microsoft? You know, I'd like to know a little more about this because we're getting surprisingly information.
You ready to take some calls?
Yeah, in just a moment. Actually, I wanted to read a couple of letters, and then we can go into some phone calls. Let's see here. We have a number of letters about the little dot on the TV set, actually, that we talked about last week. That was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And... St. Petersburg, Russia. I was in a very Soviet-style hotel room, and the TV set, this big, huge TV set with tubes and everything, had a, when you turned it off, it had a little dot that slowly disappeared in the middle of the screen. That was a trivia question for last week as to what piece of the 70s I was suddenly seeing. This person writes, in response to Emmanuel's question and finally answer, even at my young age of 17, I know what he is talking about because my mom won a nice RCA TV around 1980 on Wheel of Fortune. Congratulations to her, by the way. It still is working for us, which is also something pretty amazing. And when we turn it off, there is a green dot in the center that slowly fades away. I was just happy to know what you were talking about, but I agree. I don't think anybody would have guessed it. Fine, Joe.
Do you remember the program that was on television that actually had that as part of its credits or opening segment?
Oh, well, I know HBO turns off the TV set, but you don't see the little dot on their original programming thing. Who's got the little dot on the TV? No,
Jim,
I don't
Jim
know.
May know.
Is that Outer Limits?
Yes, it was the Outer Limits.
Outer Limits.
You remember?
Oh, yeah.
I think that's even before my time.
No, come on. Don't make me feel that old.
Well, here's another letter of, you know, occasionally we get these letters that go on their own little voyages where somebody answers a question for us and then attacks us for answering the question that way? Here's another example of that. It happens every now and then. It's always fun. I was just about to buy a 2600 hoodie. That's a hooded sweatshirt for those of you who aren't in the know. And yes, we do have 2600 hooded sweatshirts, and they look really cool, but never mind that. I was about to buy that and also Freedom Downtime, but then I saw it's only on VHS. Well, I do not have VHS anymore. Do you have any idea when it's going to be released on DVD? Or if not on DVD, do you think you could encode it on DivX or MPEG and put it on a CD? Is the reason that you might not want to release it on MPEG or DVD because it will end up on PDP networks? I think we should be able to choose the format that we view our media in. Is that not the reason you were fighting for DECFS? All right, well, let me set this person straight on a couple of things. It's not out on DVD yet because we haven't finished the DVD yet. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of money, and we've been working hard on it for about a year now. And let me tell you, it's making a lot of progress. We're getting a lot of the translations in right now for various languages that the thing's going to be captioned into, and all kinds of other features. Stay tuned for more information on that. And yes, you know, we have no intention of encrypting this thing or putting CSS on it or anything like that. So let's just not jump to conclusions here. It's taking time because, well, you know, we're not MGM Studios here, so we have to work really hard on these things.
Hey, Emmanuel, it's Lynn. I just wanted to say that the first time I saw it, I downloaded it off a peer-to-peer network, so it's already out in the wild.
Yes, yes, I know. Although I should point out that the versions I've seen on P2P networks do not do it justice. The quality is not as good. And either folks should invest a little more in bandwidth or, you know, get the original.
Yeah, the quality was very lacking. But you get the point if that's the only way you can afford to see it.
Yeah, if that's the only way, yeah, fine. But, you know, then people complain to us about the quality, and it's really kind of frustrating when people do that because the quality is fine if you look at a good version of it. And, you know, we labor to put out the best that we can possibly do.
I'm waiting for the IMAX version.
Yeah. one other thing, and then we can take some phone calls, 212-209-2900. This is something that's being circulated at SBC.com, which I believe is Southwestern Bell. Yeah, that's what I was told last. They're sending out a little memo to various people, various employees. An SBC consumer alert designed to warn customers of a potential identity theft scam in the works. Get this. Essentially, people are calling consumers at random, claiming they represent SBC, asking these unsuspecting consumers if they want to be added to the national do not call list. Now, to officially add them to the list, the callers say they need customers' personal information. And then they get all their personal information that way. I mean, yeah, it's definitely not very nice, but I have to say, it's pretty ingenious to use something like the do not call list to actually get more information out of unsuspecting people. I mean, I couldn't even have thought of this one.
I understand, too, Emmanuel, that as a thank you, they actually do put you on the no-call list.
Oh, they do?
Yes, yes. It's a courtesy.
Why do they bother?
You ready to take calls?
I'm ready to take calls.
All right, here we go.
Go ahead.
Yes, and we'll look for your personal information as well.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Emmanuel, calling from Georgia.
You know what? Keep heading south. Hope you can swim.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Emmanuel. It's Red Hack, actually.
Red Hack. You know, I've noticed you're not in the studio.
I noticed that, too.
Wow.
I'm actually listening via stream because my radio is broken. But anyway, I just wanted to comment real quickly on that kid who was arrested for the virus thing.
Uh-huh.
Whether or not he should, you know, get in trouble for it, I just wanted to say that he made the virus send information to his personal website, registered under his real name with his home address, which is how they traced him.
You get the feeling this guy wanted to be caught?
Yeah, seriously, like, to get the attention. But, I mean, he made it obviously easy to trace him. He also had it make a file that had his handle.
Well, you know, it's no wonder the FBI caught him in only a matter of a few weeks.
Exactly. But it did actually, the virus, the version he sent out did actually infect 500,000 machines and was up to infecting every 30 seconds a new machine. So it was a fairly large problem. I don't know if it took down any networks, but it did actually infect a lot of machines.
This was B?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I believe B apparently did a better job than the first one.
But, or it could have been a combination of both. I was reading up on news sites. The most interesting thing with the news sites, though, was how they had to make sure to explain that threes could be substituted for E's in the hacker language.
Oh.
Yes. It's very interesting.
Interesting.
But that's pretty much all I have to say for now, and I'll see you next week.
Okay, well, good hearing from you.
All right. Talk to you later.
Thanks. 212-209-2900.
All right. Hello, you're on the air. No, you're not.
Oh, yes.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
We're good.
Fine.
All right. The thing about the do not call list, the website is .gov, and my girlfriend originally just thought it was .org, and .org tries to charge you $5 to put you on the list.
Oh, my goodness. Well, can you do a who is on that and see who actually owns it?
I'm not sure, but she goes, they charge you for this? I said, no. What'd you put? She goes, .org. I said, no, it's .gov. So I'll let you guys know that.
Wow. Well, thanks for the tip.
Now we got right. Everybody now. Thanks.
Now, if anybody in the studio has access to a computer, you might want to run a who is on that, find out who owns it, and we get out all their information so you can tell them what you think about them charging $5 for a free service.
We're working on that. We'll have that by the end of the show, we hope.
Okay.
And, Emmanuel, I understand that we can get in touch with Bernie S.
Okay, then by all means, let's find out what's going on in the Department of Homeland Security, John Ashcroft popularity tour.
Absolutely.
We'll take a few calls until then.
Okay.
Hello, you're on the air.
That same person again.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'd like to know more about this patch, and I was told that, that if people put patches on their, you know, their computer thing to not let anyone see what they have in their computer, the government has a way of finding out and will, it's something about, it's against the law to try to hide what you have in your computer. Do you know anything about that?
Well, you're kind of looking into the future. Right now, there's no such thing, at least not officially. I think the best way to find out if there is such a thing is to have someone do exactly what you're afraid to do and have the government come after them and pretty much show their cards and say, yes, you know, we found you because we were watching what you were doing. And I think that would be a very valuable service if someone actually was able to get them to admit that. So I don't think you have anything to worry about right now, but I think all of us do have something to worry about in the future.
Near future.
I don't know how near, but pretty near.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck.
Bye.
Hello, you're on the air. But they keep calling.
Won't stop calling.
Wouldn't have to ban them. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hello, are you there?
We're here.
Well, I'm here.
All right.
I'm 91.
We're all where we're supposed to be.
I'm 91 and a half years young.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. I wish you the same and good health. I tuned in. I enjoy your show extremely, extremely. I also do not have a computer. I know absolutely nothing, but I enjoy your show every time you're on. I tuned in tonight slightly late when I heard you give out a telephone number, and if I'm correct, it has something to do with the U.S. Patriot Act about meetings. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's the what specifically is it called, Mike?
The U.S. Attorney's Office.
Who do we contact?
You can call them up, and you will probably not actually get an answer from them, but you can try anyway. It's
U.S.
Fine.
Did you say U.S. Attorney's Office?
That's right.
U.S. Attorney's Office, and the number is 212-637-2200.
That's right.
And what am I? I'm supposed to try and is it trying to get the location of places where some open meetings are going to be held?
That's right.
Am I correct?
Yes.
Reopen meetings. Have you any idea when they're scheduled for?
That's what we try and call and ask them.
Yeah, you see, the whole point is they're not being upfront with us. Like, for instance, they told Bernie S. in Philadelphia that the meeting was tonight. They told them that earlier. They're not telling the public about these so-called public meetings. So what you want to do when you call them is ask them when the public meeting is being held, and if they don't know, make sure that they call you or that you call them every day and keep asking until they either say when it is or they say, oh, we had it already, and
when the public,
despite the fact that you asked, we didn't tell you.
When the public hearings or meeting?
Meeting.
When the public meetings are held and when?
Right.
When and where?
Right.
When and where? There should be ones for every region in the states, but these are the ones for New York. You're in New York, I assume.
Yeah, right here in Manhattan.
Okay, well, basically, we're going to tell everybody when we find out when it is, and hopefully if all of our listeners are calling them, somebody will tell us when they are, so we'll be able to spread the information that way.
I'm still interested, and I want to be around to see what I hope will happen to the whole bunch.
Yeah, yeah, I hope we all are. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you.
All right, you take care.
Okay, we're going to call now to the meeting in Philadelphia, I think. So it's going to take us a minute to set up the call. We hope you have patience.
Yeah, we'll be calling Bernie S., who's there.
Okay. Well, can I still talk on the air?
Sure.
All right. Sometimes I'm put on hold when people make phone calls.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, we're not actually calling the meeting. We're calling Bernie S. in the meeting, and who knows what's going to happen when that cell phone rings in the middle of a meeting like that. He might be thrown right out onto the street.
He might be being targeted as we speak. And
yeah,
we'll give
they
away.
Might be surrounding him like, Gunsmoke style and pointing fingers at him saying, we know who you are.
Well, if they know where he is, the cell phone won't affect that. If they don't know where he is, whoops.
It takes a lot of courage, though, to be able to do something like that, walk into a meeting of people. And you have to figure, the people who know about that meeting, who are those people?
I don't know.
Someone had to tell them,
And we have something here? No, we don't.
No, we may have the information. Can you...
It's the Arkansas Attorney General, and Basically, it's an official website. It even says on the website that it's at Attorney General's Office of Arkansas. And they charge $5 per number to be put into the Do Not Call list.
Oh, this is donotcall.org?
Yeah, it's the Arkansas.
The Arkansas Attorney General is making hay out of people nationwide to put them on the federal Do Not Call list.
Mm-hmm. Well, is the Arkansas, are they accepting numbers outside of Arkansas?
Oh, I haven't checked that. I didn't want to click on the link because I didn't know how much time I had left.
Well, click on the link. Try to put in a number from 212 and see what it does.
Yeah, because in Georgia, they charge you $5 for in-state calls, and that's not uncommon.
Okay, well, it sounds to me like Arkansas got a good domain, and they're confusing people who think that they're getting the national domain when they're actually getting a state domain.
Yeah, let's hope that it's rejecting ones that are not Arkansas area codes.
We have Bernie S. on the line.
Bernie, are you there?
I'm here.
Are you
safe?
What
exactly is going on where you are?
Well, I just stepped out of this meeting, what was represented to be a town hall-style public meeting about the Patriot Act sponsored by the Department of Justice. And turned out not to be a something where public had any input at all. It was basically a script read by the local U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania addressing concerns that were addressing the so-called myths that the attorney general has been criticizing, myths being brought up at the ACLU about the Patriot Act, that sort of thing. So apparently they're on the defensive and like the Ashcroft tour that's going on right now, which is only open to an audience of law enforcement professionals, where Ashcroft is talking about the virtues of the Patriot Act and why it's important to us. And these events here are supposed to be open to the public. They're open to the public, but the public doesn't seem to have any input to the local U.S. attorneys, of which there's about 113 across the country. So,
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Was this the town meeting that they're heralding, or is this some other kind of a meeting?
No, this is it. This is the meeting.
So well,
not only
did they make it clear that there was not going to be any input,
they didn't really make it clear. They just said the U.S. attorney here just said I'm going to read a statement. And actually, it was kind of weird. It turned out to be a meeting before the township council. It wasn't held in Philadelphia. It was held in the suburbs just outside of Philly in the county where this U.S. attorney had formerly served as district attorney, prosecutor for Delaware County, Pennsylvania. And so all his friends were here. And he turned his back to the members of the public and addressed just the people from that work for the township and addressed their concerns, law enforcement, that sort of thing. And his back was entirely, the whole time, to the public.
He literally turned his back to the public.
His back was turned the entire time to the members of the public. And there were only maybe 20 people who showed up to this thing because the U.S. Attorney's Office chose to not publicize this thing at all. I mean, I called, when I read about this these town hall-style meetings a couple weeks ago in a Reuters article, and that Ashcroft had sent a letter to all U.S. attorneys encouraging them to hold a town hall-style meeting in their respective districts. I called our local U.S. attorney's office and asked about it. Nobody had heard of this letter at all. So I called several people at the office and finally got someone who seemed friendly, and I told her that I was a fan of the Patriot Act and that sort of thing. And she called me back last night to tell me that tonight there was going to be this meeting, and it was going to be the only one in the region, and that they could use my support, and they'd like me to come. So very few people called. Very people were made aware of this. I said, are you publicizing this at all? They said, well, we really haven't had time to publicize it. Now, if you remember, a week or so ago, these Ashcroft rallies that were not open to the public were highly publicized with great fanfare. But the ones that are supposedly open to the public, which are, but the public doesn't really have any input to what's being talked about, are not even being announced at all to the public. I called all the major media outlets here in Philadelphia. I called 6 television stations, 2 radio stations, and 4 newspapers. None of them had heard of this at all, with the exception of the local WB TV affiliate. And they heard about it through a friend at the Associated Press.
Bernie, I think we're just about out of time. Is that right, Ken?
That's right.
All right. Well, I hope somebody got a picture of this guy with his back to the audience. Mike, do you have that web address for people to look up their local meetings again?
I don't have it with me, but go to the Department of Justice and click on U.S. Attorney's Office and then call them and hound them until they give you an answer.
All right. We'll have more information on this next week, and I'll be back in New York then.
And you you've been listening to Off the Hook on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Coming up next,
2 in the morning in Poland. I'm going to sleep.
Good night.
Coming up next is the computer show. And I see Hank and Joe are here, so let's go for it.
Some idea as to how many blacks your vessel will hold. 170, Mr. Gardner.
170? You people seem to think this is the easiest thing in the world to do. Well, it ain't. There are ships slaving all up and down this coast. Competition, the likes of which you ain't never seen. If I can't capture enough blacks, I gotta buy them from their own chiefs.
Ladies and gentlemen, WBAI and the Midnight Ravers proudly present the 2003 NFCB Golden Reel Award winner, Fade to Black, a journey from slavery to reparations. 3 hours of music, culture, and history. Starring Mizan Noon, Corey Wilson, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Clayton Powell, and a cast of thousands. Coming to the theater of your mind from your radio station, WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City, on Friday, September 5th, 12 midnight to 3 a.m. Fade to Black is written, produced, and directed by the Midnight Ravers, the ultimate in edutainment. Admission is free, so remember that date, Friday, September 5th, 2003, from 12 midnight to 3 a.m.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.